Thanks for listening to Spinnaker Radio. This is Lisa Marino, and I'm thrilled to welcome you to a special show today. We've got something extraordinary lined up, an exclusive chat with the brilliant minds behind the Doomsday Archives, The Wandering Hour, authors Nick Eliopoulos and Zach Clark. Get ready for a dose of excitement, insights, and a peek into the world of this spine-tingling horror adventure series. This thrilling book hits the shelves on January 30th. Stick around because it's going to be a conversation you don't want to miss.
Hi, I am Zach Lauren Clark. I'm a writer and editor of books for young readers, and I'm the author of The Lock Eater and co-author of the Adventurers Guild trilogy. I'm a lifelong fantasy and horror nerd and avid Dungeons & Dragons player, and I live in Brooklyn, New York.
Hi, I'm Nick Eliopoulos. I'm a writer of kids' books and video games. My credits include the Minecraft Woodsword Chronicles chapter book series and a video game called Potionomics. I'm the co-author with Zach of the Adventurers Guild trilogy and our new series, The Doomsday Archives. I live in upstate New York, but like Zach, I was born and raised in Jacksonville.
So first, I want to start with an icebreaker. If you could curate a horror movie marathon for a night of scares, what three movies would be on your must-watch list? And you can both answer.
That is a great question, and so hard to answer. There's so many good ones. I mean, I'm going to start with what is my all-time classic favorite, which is the original Night of the Living Dead. I feel like that, of all the classic horror movies, that one still feels scary, still feels interesting. The ending is still a gut punch every time I watch it, and I watch it pretty much every October. It started the modern zombie, so it's still very influential.
Love that.
And maybe I'll start a little more contemporary. I'm a huge fan of Mike Flanagan, who's been doing a lot of the like House on Haunted Hill Netflix horror stuff. But he did a movie called Oculus, about sort of a cursed mirror and this brother-sister team who are trying to destroy it. It's just such a cerebral movie. You never really quite know if the moment you're seeing is actually happening. And I just love a good fake out. I always felt like I was a little bit off balance the entire film.
I love Mike Flanagan, he's great.
Can you share the story of how your friendship evolved from gaming buddies to co-authors?
Sure. Funny enough, Nick and I actually met in Gainesville at UF. We both grew up in Jacksonville, but lived pretty separately and were far enough in age that we didn't really connect until college. Nick was working at the university press at the time, and I was still a student at UF. And as I recall, he hosted a party at his house. Nick, sorry, remind me what the house was called.
It was the Institute for Tropical Ecology and Conservation, ITEC. We just called it the Sea Turtle House.
And he was like hosting a birthday party for a mutual friend of ours. And my friends and I ended up getting an invite. The only thing we knew about it was the word tropical. So we showed up in the most like bizarre, outrageous tropical shirts we could find. And Nick and I quickly ended up chatting about comic books and our love of geeky things and became really fast friends. And he had a comic series that I hadn't even heard of at the time, and he insisted that I read it, the Runaway series by Brian K. Vaughan. And that's kind of how the nerdy love began, but I'll let Nick delve into how it turned into a writing partnership.
Yeah, and you know, I will say that's something I really miss about Gainesville, is that you could kind of just like walk around and find someone who was having a party and make a lifelong friend. Like that's something that's much harder to do out of a college town. So Zach and I both ended up in New York City, both decided we wanted to work in publishing, and essentially New York City was the place to go. And we started playing Dungeons and Dragons together. We hadn't played it as kids, but we totally fell in love with it. And we found that we were doing like extra work. We were doing all of this extra writing to detail our characters' backstories, you know, and then we'd get together with our group and we'd have our adventure. And then Zach and I would go home and like write diary entries from the point of view of our characters. So it was like we were finally out of school. We finally had no homework, but we loved this game so much that we were giving ourselves homework, basically creative writing homework. And after a year or so of doing that, we had both been working on creative writing projects separately that weren't going anywhere. And we were like, hey, you know, like, we're really inspired by this game and we're really inspired by these sort of writing exercises that we're doing. What if we tried to do something like this, but long form, and, you know, treat it like a game, treat it like something we could pass back and forth, but with the aim to actually have a novel at the end of it. And that's what became the Adventurers Guild. It worked for us.
Yeah, that was our initial trilogy, and we're both such huge horror fans. We knew that the next project together had to be something scary, which is the genesis of the Doomsday Archives.
So on to the Doomsday Archives. I know that this series was written for the Gen Alpha, the new generation. So how did a concept of a horror adventure series for Gen Alpha come about?
You know, I am kind of a really anxious person. I think a lot about the state of the world and fret upon it. Nick and I are at that stage in our lives now where we are beginning family planning. Nick has a young son, and my husband and I are beginning the surrogacy process ourselves. And a lot of that anxiety, especially where climate change is connected, just like I worry for the generations after us. I can only imagine that they are feeling similar anxieties about the state of the world. And that actually ended up kind of being a starting point for us. The Doomsday Archives is about a group of kids who love spooky stories, but they're also really politically aware. They're aware of the state of the world. They're kind of watching the way grown-ups are maybe flubbing some really important, really dire issues. And we wanted to turn that real world anxiety, sort of examine that through the lens of horror. Say like, okay, let's say there are these kids in a town where spooky things are happening and where disappearances are pretty common, but they're seeing the adults around them kind of turn a blind eye when it's convenient. And I think that was kind of the first seed and the first starting point of this story.
Yeah, and you know, that sort of conception dovetails just really naturally with middle grade fiction generally. You know, it tends to be a creative space where it's all about showing kids, you know, in peril and showing kids sort of finding their power and figuring out how they're going to navigate the dangers of the world without direct parent or teacher involvement. That I think that's true of middle grade contemporary realistic. I think that's true of middle grade fantasy, and it's absolutely true of middle grade horror. And we felt like actually the metaphors were really, as they often are in horror, the metaphors are really close to the surface, and that, you know, you can explore some stuff and give it this veneer of horror and be really creative about what sort of monsters you're facing. But, you know, you're really talking about real stuff at the same time.
Without giving too much away, can you delve into some of the characteristics and the challenges that Emerus, Hazel, and Serena face?
Yeah, of course. Nick mentioned peril. We like to think of ourselves as best friends who write about best friends in peril. So the thrust of the story is these three friends are completely obsessed with this wiki in their town that catalogs all the cryptids, all the creepypastas and urban legends in their town. And then fairly early into the story, they make a discovery that these things are real. And that they themselves end up empowered in a way to kind of hunt down the spooky, creepy things that are preying on their town. Emrys is the viewpoint character of book one. But every book is going to follow a different kid a little more closely. And Emrys, you know, speaking of anxiety, he is probably the most anxious of the kids. He is the one who is really, really tuned into sort of the problems going on in the world. He's a bit of a pessimist as well. But that anxiety also gives him a really intense drive to roll up his sleeves and get to work and try to solve some of the problems affecting him and affecting his friends. Hazel of the group is a little more in control. She's very good at following rules. She's the girl who's academically bright, but also really good in social situations. In the second book, which Nick and I are kind of working on right now, she is going to run up against some issues where she is put into situations where her grip on control is slipping, and finds herself really at odds as she kind of scrambles to try to regain a sense of control. And Serena, the last of the kids, she's kind of the skeptic of the group. She is the one, I think, of all of them who has the clearest sense that there are maybe forces manipulating the kids. You know, the kids are very well aware that if spooky, scary things are haunting their town, that it's not really fair for three kids to be the ones who are taking up the mantle. Of fighting those things. Emrys, even though he understands this, is more gung-ho about it. And I think Serena, of all of them, is the first to want to get the group to pause and try to figure out what battle they're actually taking on in the first place.
So on to you two as authors and kind of your backgrounds. How has your childhood, or how did your childhood in Jacksonville and graduation from the University of Florida influence your writing?
That's interesting. You know, I remember always really enjoying telling my own stories as a kid. You know, and basically, like, I think it probably, as most kids do, I basically started with fan fiction. Yeah, I don't know that we had that word for it back then, but you know, I was making my own Superman and Spider-Man stories and things like that. But I didn't really have a sense that this was something that people could do professionally, or you know, that a kid from Jacksonville could actually make a career out of. I don't remember actually interacting with published authors or anything like that. And you know, so much of it is happening up in New York City, which is, felt like a world away. It really wasn't until I was in college at UF, I got an internship with the University Press of Florida, and that really just came about because I had some really intense classes one semester and I needed something easy to round out my schedule. So I was getting class credit to work at the University Press of Florida. I was like, oh, you know, these people are making books and I love books, and this is actually really, really great and interesting. And at the same time, I was taking creative writing classes, which were phenomenal. If only because they gave me deadlines for the first time and they forced me to put myself out there. You know, I think taking a creative writing class in school, even more so than whatever creative output you generate there, you're learning how to share your writing with other people and how to hear criticism and feedback. And that ultimately is kind of, I think, the difference between an amateur writer and a published professional, is that we have to figure out how to hear all this criticism and to take all this feedback and to actually turn that into, you know, actionable work where we can make our writing better. And that really all started for me at UF.
Yeah, well said. I was also a language arts writing student at UF, a creative writing major. I also, in high school in Jacksonville, went to a school called Douglas Anderson School of the Arts. So I had maybe a little bit more of an arts background than Nick did. He was, I think, more academic track when he was in grade school. But DA was a really wonderful school and a really incredible experience in terms of the high school experience. We had arts majors throughout our four-year career there, and every year had a jury in which we kind of had to show our work, show how we'd grown as artists over the last year. So there was a lot of like fun and intense pressure there, but I think I gleaned a lot from that for sure.
What is your collaborative process like? How do you navigate
creative differences?
That's a great question, and honestly, it's evolving. So we are basically putting the finishing touches on our fifth collaboration right now. And the process is changing a lot, in part because our lives have changed. Right now, Zach is doing a lot of the heavy lifting, as I have a 10-month-old at home who isn't sleeping yet. What we really did start with that shared love of sort of collaborative storytelling, tabletop role playing, and really wanted our early collaborations to feel as much like a game as possible. So we decided that we wouldn't plot out ahead of time. We would each, you know, create our characters. We would each figure out some basics of the world building, you know, the setting that we were going to be inhabiting. But then we really just wanted to kind of like run with it and have fun, and treat it almost like a game of improv, where you never tell somebody no and change direction, right? It's always yes and with improv. You're always adding. So Zach would write a chapter and I wouldn't know what it was going to be. I got to read it and it was so exciting getting a new chapter in my inbox. And then he would leave me with a cliffhanger and I would have to say, like, okay, yes, all of the things he said in this chapter are true. And now I have to add to it. And I have to find a new fun cliffhanger for him. I think we're still maintaining the heart of that process. But we're altering it as we go. We are finding that it's a little more necessary to plot in advance now, if only because it saves time on the back end. You know, it's kind of less revision if you know where you're going to end up, particularly when you're writing a mystery. We have to agree on, like, who is the secret bad guy. You know, we can't just populate our story with suspects and each be writing with a different villain in mind. And also just not as rigid as we used to be about passing individual chapters back and forth. If one of us wants to write two chapters in a row, if we move things around, especially during the revision process, we're just trying to be a bit more, I think, loose and fluid with it, while still treating it like a game so that it doesn't feel too much like work.
Yeah, and I think it helps that we are so close and share so many of the same nerdy loves. Nick and I, sometimes it feels like we share half a brain. So even when there are disagreements, or if we maybe don't see the same scene in the same way, we're pretty good at being able to come together and talk it through, and by the end of a conversation, feel like we have a pretty strong path forward.
Yeah, I will say, you know, the first clear memory I have of us disagreeing on a particular scene or moment, it was a really important learning moment for me, because, you know, we had a phone call. Zach called me up and he asked me what my intention had been for a particular plot twist. And I was able to answer, you know, I wasn't just doing it because I thought it would be cool. Like, I'm actually trying to do something, trying to say something thematically that feels important to me. And because we were able to talk not just about what was happening plot-wise, but the intention behind those choices, we were able to say, like, okay, let's look at that intention and let's figure out how we can actualize that in a way that works for both of us, that makes sense for both of us. So I think that's something that I keep coming back to whenever we're not perfectly aligned on something, getting to the heart of the intention of that particular scene or moment or character.
How do your individual strengths contribute to the synergy of your collaboration?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, the other halves of our brain that we don't share, I think, are very different. Nick is so funny. He can like throw out these bon mots and turns of phrase that just have me like rolling down the stairs as I like talk with him on the phone. I think he is really good at small moments of camaraderie where characters are just kind of together, and you sort of like, you need these moments where you can see like why the characters like each other and how they bond and how their social dynamics work. I think I tend to be a little bit more the nuts and bolts, granular. As a fantasy fan, I really love world building. And so a lot of what I do for our genres series especially is figure out how the magic works, figure out how, you know, what rules are in play and how these worlds might touch each other. But again, it's always sort of in the spirit of collaboration. And I think, you know, Nick sometimes can surprise me by creating rules and doing world building that are things that I would never have thought of, but they're so smart. And that's kind of the joy of collaboration is, even though we tend to have this sense of our lanes in the things that we excel at, I think that we can also still surprise each other, and we like to give each other the room to do that.
Yeah, well said. I do just want to also add that Zach does the pathos so well, and he's really good. He's really good at making you love a character very quickly, and then making you like hurt and like feel for that character. Where I think if left to my own devices, I would just be writing characters, you know, hanging out and eating ice cream and like saying funny things at each other, which would be fun for a few pages, but would not be a book. Zach is really good at coming in and breaking your hearts.
I'm a little more bloodthirsty.
Yeah.
What considerations do you keep in mind when writing for a young audience while making it enjoyable for older readers as well?
Yeah, you know, it's something that at the beginning of your career writing for kids, you think about a lot, but it kind of ends up becoming second nature. I think one of the keys to keep in mind is that from my experience, kids can kind of tell when you're talking down to them. So you don't want to be dumbing things down. You don't want to be treating kids as if they can't understand or engage with like big ideas and concepts, including some scary ones. I think what I try to do though is focus on a kind of simplicity of language, or at least a clarity of language. I think, you know, if I'm writing for an older audience, I might not worry so much about specific stage directions, right? I might not worry about making the action really clear, and in a sense that it's like inhabiting a physical space and is really easy to conceptualize and kind of see in your mind's eye. With writing for younger kids, I try to make it really, really clear what's happening and why and when. And if there's ambiguity, the ambiguity is there for a really specific reason, and not because I'm trying to be super artistic.
Yeah, well said. And I totally agree on all of that. I also think we try to keep a certain amount of the rule of cool in mind. You know, you when writing for kids, you want things to feel fun. And even the moments that aren't as fun, that are a little bit sad and maybe a little bit more dipped in pathos, you want things to feel alive and vivacious and feel like there's a sense of promise around the corner. I'm spinning out a little, but that's just something I do try to keep in mind as we write for younger folks.
Yeah, no, I think that's totally right. And I think, you know, kids get bored easily. Kids have a lot of entertainment competing for their attention. And they're not going to stick with a book that is dull because, you know, for cultural capital or whatever, right? You have to actually be entertaining
right.
them.
Right. Luckily, I get bored easily too, so that makes it easier.
So the Doomsday Archives will be a series. Do you see an end to the series, or do you just plan to keep writing until it naturally comes to an end?
So when we first conceived the series and pitched it and we're shopping it around, we had an end in mind. We basically pitched a 3-book arc, which is what the Adventurers Guild was, you know, assuming that we would have, you know, a finite amount of space. If we were even lucky, we would, you know, be able to tell this story, have it published, but would have a finite number of books to tell it in. Our editor, Tiff Liao at Zando, actually came back and said that we should be thinking of it more in terms of an open-ended kind of episodic Monster of the Week kind of structure. So we've reconceived the series so that it could ostensibly go on forever. We kind of know we established the structure with the first book and it's repeatable. We just, you know, come up with new monsters and new magical relics each time. I think we do have a sense of where we would like to wrap the story when we ultimately know, you know, it's time to bring it to a close. But in the meantime, we're assuming that we've got some room to breathe and to really let the characters surprise us and try some new things.
Yeah, I don't have more to add. That was well said.
Were there specific horror or fantasy influences that played a significant role in shaping the fantasy world of the Doomsday Archives?
There absolutely were. Another thing, I mentioned that the kids in this story are obsessed with this wiki that's cataloging the spooky things that go around that are happening in their hometown. Every chapter actually begins with one of those wiki entries. So we were able to, there's the longer form story of Emrys, Serena, and Hazel, but we were also able to tell these micro stories through these wiki entries, and those were especially rich moments for us to sort of give nods to the horror stories and tropes that we love so much. We also, I think as we were beginning the series, and our editor encouraged us to do this especially, each of the kids kind of has a horror genre that they think of as their favorite. Emrys, being as anxious and cerebral as he is, he tends to really love cosmic horror. Hazel is a big fan of the sort of classic monster movies. And Serena, who's a little more realistic, is into the like contemporary slasher genre. But all of those get nods, especially some of our favorite stories in the wiki entries. And we really tried to pull from as many different horror inspirations as we could for those.
With your release on January 30th, what are your hopes and expectations for the book's reception?
Oh, once you've had a few books published as an author, you try not to have hopes or aspirations. I mean, the funny thing is that you're always working ahead. So we're finishing book two now. My guess is that we're already running behind on book three. So by the time a book actually comes out, you're kind of like two steps ahead of it. First of all, it's already getting really nice reception, which is wonderful to see. It's a Junior Library Guild selection. It's an made the indie bookstores indie next list. It's gotten a couple of starred reviews, so that's really fantastic, really heartwarming as an author. But the what ends up impacting me the most is when we actually hear from kids. One of the really exciting aspects of this book release is that we're doing promotional publicity for it, but most of it is actually going into schools and libraries and getting to actually interact with kids as opposed to doing like a bookstore or a convention circuit. I've done a lot of Minecraft books, and the Minecraft books are fun for me, but they're not the books of my heart really. It's a gig, it's a licensed property. But the letters that I get from kids who love those books, and specifically, or even from their teachers or their parents who will say like, hey, my kid has always told me that they hate reading, but they love your books, and they want to do their book report on you. How old are you? What's your birthday? It's not online anywhere. That always makes me really, really happy to hear from the kids. So I guess that's my hope. My hope is that we hear from kids who are getting something out of the book.
Yeah, I totally agree. And Nick works in video games now, and I've switched to full-time freelance. But we both also previously worked as editors in the kids space. We worked on the kinds of books that we write, and you can only write and create the best possible book that you can, and send it out into the world and hope for the best. There's often not a ton of rhyme or reason to which books explode and which are a little quieter. But we are both immensely proud of the series, and really, really excited to see how it's going. And working with the team at Zando has just been a total dream. So I'm already feeling really, really thrilled.
So amazing talking to you both.
Those were great questions,
Yeah.
honestly. We haven't gotten most of those before, so that
Oh,
was really
really?
fun. Yeah.
Oh,
Yeah,
that's
you got our honest off the cuff
exciting.
answers.
Ooh, got exclusive answers. Love that.
And that's a wrap on my chat with Nick Eliopoulos and Zach Clark, the masterminds behind the Doomsday Archives, The Wandering Hour. Don't forget, this hair-raising adventure hits the bookstores on January 30th. I'm Lisa Marino, and thanks for tuning in to Spinnaker Radio. If you missed any part of our talk, no worries, catch it on our website, spinnakerradio.com, today.